be seated.
Court is ready to hear argument from appellant in N. Ray Birdwell.
May it please the court, Ms. Acevedo will present argument for the appellant. Appellant has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the issue before the court is whether a conviction for conspiracy to defraud the IRS is an intentional crime as defined by our compulsory discipline statute, meaning, is it a crime which requires proof of knowledge or intent, and if it is it a crime involving moral turpitude per se? I'd like to take the court through some of the federal case law, which talks about the nature of this crime, what the elements are, what is required for a conviction when the IRS is the victim, when the statute's used, and that the courts carefully examine both the concept and the evidence under 371 to ensure valid convictions, and hopefully then to convince the court that this is an intentional crime because it is a specific intent crime and because it always involves moral turpitude as this court has defined it. The nature of the crime is a conspiracy which at its heart is the concealment of income and assets in order to evade tax. It is a tax conspiracy. It is commonly referred to throughout the federal jurisdictions to find conspiracy. The elements which are required for the government to achieve a conviction are the existence of an agreement to achieve an unlawful objective, an overact in furtherance of the objective of the conspiracy, and an agreement whose intent is to defraud the Internal Revenue Service.
Is that the element that constitutes moral turpitude?
In this case, because you have a specific intent, so then you move over to moral turpitude, it would be the intent to specifically defraud the Internal Revenue Service. You have to have that intent. Let's talk just a bit about the agreement and the objective. The Atkinson case out of the 11th Circuit tells us that the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that each defendant had a deliberate, knowing, specific intent to join the conspiracy. There has to be a meeting of the mind. So it's not enough to merely be associated with members of conspiracy. Simple knowledge isn't enough. Even acquiescence in the objective or the purpose isn't enough unless you have that intent and agreement to accomplish a specific illegal objective. You don't get there. And the objective, you have to agree, a purpose or objective of the tax conspiracy has to be the evasion of federal taxes. The U.S. versus Goldberg, Collins case, the Atkinson case, the Romer case tell you that the defendant must have the specific intent to defraud the IRS of tax revenues. If the government can't show this, they don't get a conviction. And the courts have even said that if your actions simply have the collateral effect of obstructing the IRS and its ability to collect or ascertain taxes, that's not enough. Even if it's foreseeable, it has to be an objective or the purpose of the conspiracy itself.
Well, Ms. Acevedo, are you talking about looking at the nature of the offense by looking at Section 371, or are you talking about the underlying indictment and the facts of a particular case?
You don't, I think that what you're asking me is knowing which agency is being defrauded is not going into the facts of the case. First of all, just the face of the judgment tells you that. You don't have to look at anything else to know that. Second, knowing which agency is defrauded is different from talking about what manner and means was set out in order to defraud the agency.
Well, you agree that the Duncan case precludes us from looking at the underlying facts, and we are required to just look at the nature of defense with a Chapter 8 proceeding.
That is what the Duncan case says, and in this case, you don't have to look at any facts because no matter how it turns out, it's always going to involve moral turpitude. But I do want to say, just in general, that you know the policy behind not going into the facts of a case and in compulsory discipline didn't originate in the context of is this moral turpitude or not. Really, the policy behind that and what the genesis of that was is that you didn't want the lawyer to come in and try to retry the issue of guilt. And so, while it's not necessary in this case, just the general idea of looking at the judgment or the indictment or even a plea agreement is not going to destroy the summary nature of compulsory discipline. In fact, if I recall correctly, it's the position that both Justice Owens and Enoch took in the Duncan case. So even though it's not necessary in this case, that's what the origin of that was. Now, probably most importantly is the defraud clause itself. And the case law also tells us, if you look at United States versus Caldwell, the Jackson case, United States versus Collins, and the United States Supreme Court case of Hammerschmidt, tells you that it's limited to wrongs that are done by deceit and dishonesty. It's clear in the statute. That's part of the intent element of the crime, is the intent to interfere with or obstruct the Internal Revenue Service's ability to ascertain and collect taxes by some dishonest means. So just making it harder for the government isn't going to get you there. It's only when you engage in conduct that's deceitful and dishonest. So what you have is you've got to know the liability for federal taxes. You have to knowingly, voluntarily enter into the agreement whose objective is to defraud the Internal Revenue Service. You have to knowingly and voluntarily participate in the conspiracy, and you have to also agree to defraud the IRS by means which are deceitful and dishonest. There aren't any cases out there, and almost every single federal jurisdiction has dealt with this crime, where an individual has been convicted and the conviction has been upheld, where it didn't have the specific intent to defraud the IRS, and when it didn't involve means that were deceit or that involved dishonesty. If you look at the cases, they're virtually all follow the same kind of pattern. The facts almost always involve some kind of sophisticated scheme, some kind of complicated transactions in order to conceal the income and the assets or the source of the income. You've got laundering of money, you've got the setting up of sham corporations, you've got backdating documents, you've got the filing of false income reports, you've got structuring transactions so that you can't tell, or it's so complicated you can't tell how much money is actually there. And there's not a single case out there in which a lawyer has been convicted in just the course of simply just representing their client. If you look at the lawyer cases that are out there, there's United States versus Craig out of the Sixth Circuit, United States versus Hurley out of the First Circuit. It always comes down to the evidence in the case. Is there evidence to show that what the lawyer was doing, that he agreed to be part of this plan and voluntarily participated in the scheme, which was to try to shield their client's income and assets from the government? And it's these elements that you have that squarely fit within this court's definition of moral turpitude. It inherently involves moral turpitude because it requires a specific corrupt intent to defraud the IRS, and because of the deceit and the dishonesty that's required in the commission of the offense.
Can you distinguish Toohey?
The Toohey case. Yes, in Toohey, first of all, it wasn't a conspiracy against the IRS, but it was a conspiracy to defraud. And second, what Toohey actually says is that this conduct may reasonably be given the label of fraud or moral turpitude. But in any case, fraud or moral turpitude are not elements of this crime. Meaning here,
well, but
the
doesn't that just establish your opponent's position, that language?
No, I don't think it does, because what they were talking about is what are the elements the government has to show. They weren't talking about whether this kind of crime involves moral turpitude. They certainly weren't considering it in a lawyer context, and they certainly weren't considering it in the moral turpitude definition that this court has developed. So that would be my response to Toohey. And again, this is a tax conspiracy. It's a revenue offense. This court has held both in Humphreys, which actually was a tax evasion case, personally in Humphreys, and in the Stevens case, which was a bar admissions case in which the lawyer had failed to file income taxes for 14 years, that this is the kind of conduct which adversely reflects on a lawyer's fitness to practice law. Our own definition of serious crime includes the crime of conspiracy. The only other jurisdiction that I could find out there which has dealt with the issue head on was the District of Columbia. And in that jurisdiction, for the purpose of attorney discipline, it also held that it was a crime of moral turpitude per se. And I think that you will also find that the courts they have addressed over and over again this language, and they're very careful when they look at, they carefully scrutinize the indictment and the evidence, they construe the indictments narrowly, they say the government has to allege and prove the fraudulent scheme. And so they're careful when they look at these cases to ensure that valid convictions are met. In concluding, we would argue again that a conviction for this crime is always going to subject a lawyer to compulsory discipline because it is a specific intent crime. It always involves deceit and dishonesty. It is a revenue offense, and the nature of this offense, with the goal being to defraud the Internal Revenue Service, implicates virtually every professional quality pertaining to the integrity needed of an officer of the court. It reflects a deep, premeditated criminal scienter. We would ask this court to find that this crime is an intentional crime and then to render disbarment against Ms. Birdwell. As you will recall, Ms. Birdwell did receive a sentence of incarceration and therefore disbarment is mandated.
Any questions?
Thank you.
Thank you. The court is ready to hear argument from Ms. Pine.
May it please the court, Mr. Lee will present argument for the appellee.
Honorable Justice of the Supreme Court, may it please the court. My name is Steve Lee. I'm an attorney officing here in Austin, Texas, and I represent the appellee, Carol Birdwell. I disagree with the bar's characterization of this case as even being an intentional crime case because due to the way the statute was written, I think erroneously, I think there's a typographical error that's been carried forward. She is not even eligible for serious crime consideration. If the court is to rule that this is an intentional crime, it would mean that a lawyer convicted of this offense placed on probation would automatically have to be disbarred. I don't think that's appropriate. The real issue is whether this is a moral turpitude per se offense.
Didn't the Supreme Court say that in the Hammerschmidt case in 1924?
That this is moral turpitude?
That this involved deceit, craft, trickery, dishonest means.
Those are the catchphrases used.
And isn't that, in fact, what this court has then said involves moral, those particular items involve moral turpitude?
I would disagree.
Okay, why?
Because defraud is used in this statute as set forth in the authority cited.
Talk about moral turpitude. Did the Supreme Court in Hammerschmidt characterize the 371 offense as a crime involving deceit, craft, trickery, or dishonest means?
Yes.
And hasn't this court said that those particular things involve moral turpitude?
No.
We didn't say that?
No. This court has said that.
What about Duncan?
You haven't said anything about craft or trickery. I've never seen any case by this court discussing those phrases or even attempting to define them. And secondly, fraud is used by this court in describing previous fraud offenses have been where there's been the intention to deprive a person of property or money by deceptive means. In this case, and in the IRS cases, it's not the case.
How has this court defined crimes of moral turpitude?
This court, I think, has struggled, just like most people and most courts have, with moral turpitude. It's claimed that sometimes it's said that it's crimes involving deliberate dishonesty or deliberate violence. It is said that moral turpitude, it goes back to the Bouvier definition that Justice Jackson talks about in the DeGeorge case, of base, vile, depraved, you know, contrary to good morals. It has used the vague phrase of as it reflects on the lawyer's fitness to practice law.
And in Duncan, we called it dishonesty or deceit.
Correct. But we have two other possible elements, which is craft or trickery. And this would be like in the Caldwell case, the example that the court forced the U.S. Attorney's Office to admit under their theory of prosecution, the husband who asked his wife, would you buy me a radar detector, has engaged in a conspiracy to evade a lawful federal function. That's what the bar has asked you to do in this case, by the way, is to hold as a matter of public policy that is moral turpitude per se under a statute which criminalizes conduct, which says basically, don't allow yourself to be in a position where it looks like you agreed with someone else, even if it's a government agent, you know, who lures you into it, to frustrate any purpose of any agency or department of the U.S. government, even if you never attempt to do what's discussed. Remember, the cases say that neither the objective sought nor the so-called overt act you're charged with has to be independently illegal.
Would you respond to your opponent's argument that there is plenty of case law out of the federal circuit that impose an intent or knowledge requirement on a 371 offense?
Again, it is a vague and strange intent requirement. It says that you don't even have to know that the statute that you are violating a law. You don't have to intend to violate the law. The Khalid case that they cite is an interesting one in which the court was trying to prosecute a fellow for violating the structuring laws. In other words, making bank deposits in cash slightly under $10,000 to avoid the bank reporting. But the federal prosecutors conceded, we can't prove that case. We can't prove these people even knew there was a statute prohibiting doing this. However, intent, it says in Khalid, is not a requirement. That if you decide to charge them under the simple so-called defraud clause, in other words, attempt to frustrate any lawful governmental purpose, they don't have to prove that that was what you were doing.
What about the Atkinson case? How do you respond to her argument as to it?
Atkinson.
The 11th Circuit case.
I'm trying to remember Atkinson. It seems to me that it was cited for a very general proposition of the way many courts have stated the intent requirements, but I don't recall it talking about a specific intent to engage in conduct that would be defined as fraudulent. In fact, the cases keep coming back to, we are not talking about the kind of fraud, the mental state that would apply to a mail fraud case or a bankruptcy fraud case. It's the taking the Hammersmith definition through U.S. versus Dennis, which then goes through McNally and Tanner, you find that they say fraud as used in this statute has a fundamentally different meaning than it does anywhere else in the law. And all it means is to agree, which can be found from circumstantial evidence, to engage with another person, even if you don't do it, in conduct which would tend to frustrate any legitimate governmental function. That just doesn't sound like moral turpitude per se. I would admit, you could certainly engage in conspiracies that everybody would say are just vicious and absolutely improper. But it also means that this statute criminalizes conduct which is not vicious and not absolutely improper. And the bar wants, I don't know if you can narrow this to only what they call revenue offenses. There's one of their excited cases that this is not a revenue offense. This is the general conspiracy statute. You know, can we confine it to that? You notice that it's called defraud the U.S., but the charge is impede or impair the IRS. But it could be impede or impair the ATF by falsely filling out an application to get a gun, a Brady application. It could be for agreeing, you know, two gentlemen agreeing when they cross the border in from Mexico, you know, we're only supposed to bring in one bottle of whiskey each. Let's put a couple in the trunk. You know, they could make two trips and achieve the same result. They're just lazy. But they have impeded or impaired the customs service when they do that. It could be people who don't declare everything they bring into the country. You know, if wife says to husband, do I need to declare all these dresses and things I bought? I don't know. And she doesn't do it. They've engaged in a conspiracy to frustrate the purposes of the customs service. I don't know if that would be moral turpitude. I mean, that is the problem with this. That is the problem, I think, with this whole case, is that the bar has tried to focus on irrelevancy. They tried to focus on that it was the IRS whose purpose was allegedly frustrated. But they admit that we can't look at the facts.
But Ms. Acevedo says, though, that the courts have imposed on this statute a specific intent. You have to know that you're frustrating the agency. You're arguing, well, if you look at the statute, they can be convicted for not doing this. But Ms. Acevedo says, well, wait a minute. If all they show is they had an agreement and they did this, they're not going to get there. They have to show that as a part of this agreement, the party specifically intended to do it to avoid whatever the government was trying to have.
But is that moral turpitude to avoid what is purported to be a lawful government objective when it doesn't even have to violate a civil statute or a criminal statute? You know, the act that you undertake to do can be perfectly legal. So how can that be moral turpitude? For example, in the Caldwell case, the court mentions that you could argue the threshold of dishonesty is so low under this doctrine that you could argue that if someone had a final IRS lien against them and was, other than that, not bankrupt, so that that debt, which is not dischargeable, could not be discharged in bankruptcy, to file a bankruptcy petition just to slow down the execution on that level could be considered sufficiently dishonest to reach within the purview of the statute. So, I mean, this is the kind of thing that business litigator lawyers do all the time. They, you know, when they see a client who's having trouble and the IRS is coming down, on one of the first spots is, let's file bankruptcy. The Caldwell Court, the Ninth Circuit, the same circuit that Ms. Birdwell pled under, was saying that the filing of petition under those circumstances could support a prosecution under the dishonesty requirement as enunciated in the cases. And I don't know that dishonesty is some benchmark that we can all hang our hats on, because we also have to say that the statute involves conduct that involves craft or trickery.
Has there ever been a conviction under 371 where there wasn't a finding of deceit or dishonesty?
They don't submit it that way. You have to find that there was the use of deceit, craft, trickery, or dishonesty. I don't see one where it was presented to the jury on a specific theory. And as Mr. Brown pointed out in his testimony before BOTA, these are really vaguely defined terms. There is not a sound definition for any of those terms. It is, again, as pointed out in the Goldstein article, all manner of circumstantial evidence, hearsay, co-conspirator, alleged testimony comes in, and the limits of relevancy are stretched thin in these sort of cases, because we're inferring agreements from conduct with people, we're inferring intent from conduct or apparent manifestations of conduct. From the point of view of considering attorney discipline, I think it's a fine thing to say that, you know, attorneys who are convicted of crimes that involve dishonesty ought to be sanctioned. But that is, to me, just sort of a broad hortatory phrase. I mean, discovery disputes. I don't think people say lawyers ought to be disbarred over discovery abuse disputes, but they frequently involve craft, attempts to construe a statute in such a way as to avoid revealing this, that, or the other, or to make it just a little tougher for the other lawyer to pry some information out of you. Is that immoral? Usually not, not unless you know of something and just flatly lie and claim it doesn't exist, but is it dishonest? I'd say yes. Under the general theories of what discovery is, we're supposed to put the facts out there on the table. Avoid controversies that don't matter. Let the truth rule. But I would suggest to you the lawyer might be disciplined for giving up information contrary to a client's advice if it wasn't a legal, ethical, criminal duty to make that disclosure. Now, I'm not suggesting necessarily that the ruling of this court would open the door to all manner of lawyers being prosecuted for federal crimes. But nonetheless, I would just like to say that dishonesty is a phrase that doesn't have a standard fixed meaning. And the dishonesty described in the cases that I've cited in my brief is clearly of such a low threshold that, again, when the court tells me that a husband who asked his wife to buy him a radar detector, he's attempting to evade a lawful government function, detection of speeders, by craft, trickery, maybe not dishonest, maybe deceptive, I don't know. That just can't be moral turpitude per se to me.
I'm more concerned about what happened in this case. What was the government's best argument about an intentional deceit by your client?
I have no idea, because we're told that we're looking at whether the offense is per se moral turpitude. So I have not examined with her what were you exactly accused of, what were your defenses, what did you think, who did this, that, or the other. That, if the bar had chosen to take her before a grievance committee claiming her conduct was unethical, I'd want to know all that. But that's the point. This process is so that people who end up getting convicted or who accept pleas will be dealt with summarily. If it's clear that in all circumstances what they did must involve moral turpitude, there's going to be a compulsory price paid. If, however, we need to look at the indictment to figure out, well, what exactly is it you're supposed to have done? What have you pled to here? I see. Well, then that's a factual determination. That's a determination best left to a grievance committee under the standard process. We argued that at trial. We told the bar beforehand. Instead, they proceeded in this manner. That's my answer to that. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
No, but go on.
I'm sorry. Well, if you'd like to restate it, I'll take another try.
If we decide that craft and trickery is just the same thing as dishonesty, do you now lose?
I don't know. I mean, that is the thing that I suppose is scary about a case like this, is that we are dealing with phrases, even the phrase fraud itself in the standard definition of actually trying to cheat somebody out of money or property. There's been a lot of law review articles written on the vagueness of that, but here we're, fraud is used in a term that most of us are not generally familiar with, so that the statement intent to defraud really doesn't mean what we think it might mean, and where dishonesty doesn't appear to mean a sort of a, I would think that if you find that craft, trickery, and deceit are coextensive with dishonesty, and you find that dishonesty is used under 18 U.S.C. 371 is exactly in the same context as described in, say, the State Bar versus Heard case, then I think discipline would have to lie.
Well,
and I hope you'll come to that.
I'm having a hard time understanding your argument. The United States Supreme Court talked about, when we talk of, you keep talking about having to be all these things. It says deceit, and Hammerschmidt says deceit, craft, or trickery, or at least by means that are dishonest.
Well, I'm not saying
so,
it has to be all those.
You're making it sound like we've got to define craft, and you've got to have all of those things present in order to have that.
No, Your Honor, I'm saying it can be any of them, and when they submit it as four possible mental states, you don't know which one's been chosen. And if you look at the Hammerschmidt thing, I've always found this unusual. They put deceit first, craft next, trickery, and then they throw in dishonesty like an afterthought, or at least. Well, in sort of my own moral worldview, craft and trickery are less than dishonesty.
They say
you know?
To conspire to defraud the United States means primarily to cheat the government out of property or money, but it also means to interfere with or obstruct one of its lawful governmental functions by deceit, craft, or trickery, or at least by means that are dishonest.
And
why is that hard to understand?
That's several statements at once. It says that it can be the intent to cheat the government, but it can also mean just the attempt to frustrate a governmental function. And it can be by any of four mental states they describe: deceit, craft, trickery, or at least conduct, which would be described as dishonest. And then we have cases describing the threshold of dishonesty as being not what I think most people think of as dishonest, just knowing what the truth is and flat lying about it, but filing a bankruptcy petition where you can't get the relief that you're seeking in the pleading, where the objective is to slow down the IRS so we can marshal some money to pay off this levy. Well, if that is your debt that puts you into bankruptcy and it is not a qualifying bankruptcy debt, then theoretically that is a dishonest filing. That to me stretches the meaning of dishonesty so thin as to make it difficult to call that moral turpitude. I mean, lawyers are encouraged to sort of, I mean, what do accountants and lawyers do? Here's what the IRS has lately been ruling. You know, you could try this. You know, as one, I think it was Justice Frankfurter said, that it's everyone's right to try to avoid the payment of taxes. It's when you cross the line into evasion that you've criminalized it. Well, here, we've got avoidance criminalized if it in any regard is construed as impeding or impairing the lawful function of the IRS. And again, I want to remind you that unless this court can hold that this offense, there's really no such offense as impeding or impairing the IRS. We all can see that. There's only the offense of conspiring to do it. So we have this notion you can conspire to do something which in and of itself is not a crime. And so it's the conspiring which is the crime. And it is a crime to conspire to impede or impair in any regard any governmental function. And you've got to remember what the breadth of the federal governmental functions are, from the FEC and election filing, the FTC and advertising, and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the National Park Service. I just don't see how a crime that describes you don't have to violate a criminal statute, you don't have to violate a civil statute, you don't even have to know that what your object is illegal. None of the conduct you engage in has to be independently illegal, but nonetheless, it's moral turpitude per se. In all instances, the only way you can get a conviction is if you are an immoral person. I just don't believe that. I have to refer you back to the brief. I mean, my feeling on this is that this is important not only to Ms. Birdwell personally and her livelihood, but to any other lawyers that might find themselves similarly situated. The Goldstein article I've cited is exhaustive and much better than anything I could create. Mr. Goldstein's qualities as a lawyer and his scholarship are outstanding. And, you know, if I have not been able to convey what I'm trying to get across, I hope that will not be held against Ms. Birdwell, because I sincerely believe that this is not an offense involving moral turpitude per se, as those of us involved in the Texas attorney discipline system have come to understand that term. Well, really in the second half of the 20th century, that's when all the developments in the law came.
Any other questions? Thank you.
May it please the court. I would just like to respond to a couple of items raised by Mr. Lee. The first is that this court's definition of moral turpitude is pretty specific in Duncan. I think initially when the court took up the compulsory discipline cases, as in the Humphreys case, it recognized that there were a lot of different definitions out there, and it made an effort to narrow that down and to define it, and it does include acts that involve deceit and dishonesty. The other thing I want to talk about is that there is a statement that keeps being repeated that you could have a lawful objective and carry it out by lawful means and still be convicted of this crime. And that's an absolute misstatement of both the general conspiracy law and the 371 conspiracies that we're looking at today. What you see in the cases is you see this language that says neither the conspiracy's goal nor the means used to achieve it need be illegal. If you actually look at what the origin of those statements are and in the context in which they're given, what the cases are actually saying is two things. One, that the government doesn't have to refer to another part of the criminal code other than Section 371, because the substantive offense, defrauding the United States, is contained within the statute. So you don't have to refer to another part of the criminal code. And so the objective is always illegal, because the objective is always to defraud the Internal Revenue Service. Second, what they say is, nor does the government have to prove and plead a violation of the criminal law independent of 371. And you see that in Collins and Perkin and Jackson and the Tanner case. And what they're usually, the way that that comes up is, again, in one of two ways. The first is the government will plead a 371 conspiracy, and they'll use, in describing what the manner and means are, the filing of false income tax returns. And the defendants will say, well, you didn't plead the tax fraud provision, or you didn't prove all the elements under the tax fraud provision. And the courts say, you don't have to prove some other violation of the criminal code. This is being used to show what manner and means was used, what deceitful and dishonest means were used in order to consummate the conspiracy. And that's the context in which you see it arise. The other context is when the means is not illegal. And the two cases that I've seen this come up with is money laundering didn't used to be illegal. And so the means and method that were used to carry out the conspiracy was laundering the money. And they say, hey, what I was doing was perfectly legal. And they said, well, you don't have to prove that money laundering is illegal. It's simply to show that these are the means that you use to carry out your objective, which was to defraud the Internal Revenue Service.
Ms. Osmond, let me get you to comment on the opposing counsel's argument that if we decide the case in your favor, the way you would like us to decide it, it would have potentially much broader impact. As one hypothetical example, if I were to go to Mexico and bring back two bottles of tequila, speaking hypothetically, then I would be subject to disbarment. And that's one of many examples you raised.
Okay. And where is the conspiracy? Who have you agreed with?
The buddy I was with.
Okay, the buddy that you're with. Okay. And so, again...
One for him, one for...
Okay, and let's just set aside for these things, for now, that it has nothing, that has nothing to do with defrauding the Internal Revenue Service, which
so
I think is...
defrauding the customs.
Okay, the defrauding. And so, what you would say, what you would have to show, okay, is that you had some intent to, the specific intent to defraud the Customs Service. Okay? And you agreed to do so, and that you used dishonest or deceitful means to keep them from, I guess, knowing that you had these bottles of tequila.
Which you could do by just not declaring.
You just stick them in the trunk and come
and
up.
Again, yeah.
Speaking hypothetically.
And again, I guess, you know, I don't know if that would get you there or not. I'm not sure that, you know, the cases that talk about this say, like, merely failure to disclose income isn't enough to get you convicted of defrauding the IRS. And they go through these examples about how dishonesty and deceit, like the radar detector thing. I mean, the Caldwell case says you have to have this element of deceit and dishonesty because otherwise, I mean, what they say is that you wouldn't get convicted under that radar.
But the point, perhaps, that he has made, the point that it doesn't seem like you are capable of responding to right now is that, I mean, arguably I can see different levels of deceit or different, some deceits seem to have greater impact than other deceits, and perhaps deceits of, I'm not sure if bringing two bottles of tequila in without declaring it would amount to an offense subject to causing someone to be disbarred or not. I'm not sure. But it seems like you have no answer to that, if in fact they were stuck in the trunk and you didn't declare anything, then you're going to be doing something else for the rest of your life other than practicing law.
Well, and I guess that the only response I really have is where are those cases? I mean, where are they? I mean, it's one thing. That's why I think you can't ignore the federal law that's out there on how these statutes are actually used. I mean, there isn't a case out there where you're coming back from across the border and that's what they've done and that's, and you've been, you know, convicted of that crime. And I think that that's the only real, I guess, fallout from the Duncan cases that we have is that we of course, spend no time actually looking at what the nature of this crime is, right? But you end up spending your time conjuring up fact situations for which nobody has ever been convicted.
But it doesn't, it doesn't mean they couldn't be.
But, I mean, I guess I don't think that they could be in the situation that you have. But, again, I'm not really sure if that should be the focus of what it is that we're looking at. I mean, the federal law has taken this statute and it has delineated what is required, and you look at the fact situations, and in this one in particular, which has to do with defrauding the IRS, and they all involve specific intent. They all involve deceit and dishonesty, and I'm not really sure I understand sort of the low threshold of dishonesty, you know, just filing one false income tax return, you know, just setting up one, you know, front corporation to funnel my money through. And so, in this situation, I have not heard any fact situation in which somebody could be convicted of defrauding the Internal Revenue Service where it is not going to involve the specific intent required and where it's not going to involve sufficient level of deceit and dishonesty if you can actually make some sort of level of dishonesty out there.
Any other questions?
Well, let me just ask you as a policy matter, what would be wrong with finding that this is not per se moral turpitude and letting the grievance process weed that out based on the particular facts of each case?
I
mean, it's not like they get off scot-free if it's
well,
not per
Well, actually,
case.
I don't think that the grievance process would be available. The grievance process has a 4-year statute of limitations. And just looking at the part of the indictment which you pled to, I think that the act started in 87 and ended, I think that I'm correct in saying something like February of 96. So maybe we have 3 weeks to file something. And it would depend on which act, I guess, that was. I mean, that's what happened in Duncan. In Duncan, we were beyond the statute of limitations, and so Duncan did get all the suffering.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the second clause, the court will take another brief recess.
All right.